Ho, 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 and welcome everyone to a festive episode of the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, joining me as always is Pete, who's here live in the palatial Fantastic Geek studio. Hello, Pete.
Oh, fudge.
And indeed, we've been teasing it on Twitter for a couple days now, and a couple people figured it out, in part because it's not that difficult to figure out. Pete, what are we doing today?
We will be watching along, hopefully with you, the 1983 classic, A Christmas Story, here in its 30th anniversary this year, and all the magic and the wonder it beholds. And we will not, in this continuity, acknowledge the schmishmortion that is A Christmas Story 2, that a year after its direct-to-video release has now made the rounds on the likes of AMC Family. I believe I saw it on the Country Music channel one wow. day. Yes. Other than that reference there, we will not acknowledge it in this dojo.
Fair enough. So we have the video queued up. We are actually 9 seconds in, which is right after the MGM Lion completes its roar. So why don't you hit pause now, get your video queued up. If not, if you don't have it handy, by the way, if you're watching on TV or whatever it might be, we also should have a pretty clean second audio track here on the podcast that should make things sound nice, you know, in the background. So if you're listening without the movie or you know whatnot, we should have some decent audio, not just on our Speechify end, but also the actual clean audio from it. So, all right, listeners, do you have the DVD ready? 9 seconds in, right after the lion's roar has continued. And I guess we'll go 3, 2, 1, go. Sound good, Pete?
Sounds good.
All right, 3, 2, 1, go. Oh, that's perfect timing there.
All right. And I think really what's important to understand is the historical perspective on this film. This was a film that, again, 1983 release. And anyone who tells you that they saw this in a theater, you can discount 9 out of 10 of them. You can call them liars. This movie was an abject failure in theaters. And it wasn't until video, it wasn't until pay cable that it really gathered its grassroots following, to the point now where TBS, over the last, I want to say 10, if not 15 years, might be the outside of it, playing it 24 hours a day, beginning on 8 p.m. on Christmas Eve, straight through until 8 p.m. on Christmas night, has really become a true national tradition.
Pete, I feel like it's probably closer to the neighborhood of like 20 years, because I feel like I don't remember when I discovered this movie. I have a vague memory of watching it in its entirety at a friend's house who had recorded it off TV, which would have been high school if indeed it was that late. But just kind of being aware, this is the Shoot Your Eye Out movie. I think it's been on quite a while.
This is my hands down favorite Christmas film, and you know, well before TBS had begun that tradition, this was a staple in my home.
Well, you know what? I mean, there's so much about the Christmas tradition, which is, I think, in a certain sense, settled in the 1950s-ish. You know, whether it's a lot of the classic songs, whether it's, I know that, you know, the Coca-Cola depiction of Santa, I think, is maybe like late 30s, early 40s, but it's just kind of that. So much of Christmas harkens back to that era of the certain type of cars that we're seeing here. You know, men wearing hats, women in dresses in the home, that kind of traditional aesthetic, for better or worse. There's so much that it harkens back to, and this is a movie that kind of revels in that. Obviously made in the 80s, but looking back, as opposed to, say, movies made in the 50s about the contemporary day, this is kind of so intentionally the Christmas of our childhood, despite the fact that neither you nor I were
yes,
you know, twinkles in our parents' eyes. It's just that past, you know, kind of having this shot here of the window and all the toys and whatnot, it just kind of, I don't know, it's so evocative of, like, I don't know, as a grown up, I feel like I've lost most of that feeling of like, ooh, what will I get on Christmas Day? That's just mostly like, I mean, it's about the more important things, right? Spending time with family, and yeah, have you done right by the people you want to, you know, show your care to and all that, but you know, we all want the nice thing. We all want that Red Ryder BB gun or whatever it might be.
Speak for yourself, Matt. I'm still somebody, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed on Christmas. It's got to be the only morning of the year, you know, up and ready to go. Just to fact check before, in 1997, TNT began the 24-hour marathon, 24 hours of Christmas Story. So, you know, we're talking 16th year to come around this year, so right about there.
I'm unsurprised your memory is so good.
The other thing I think it's important to point out, you know, we just saw a couple minutes ago in the credits here, two things. One, you know, and you're hearing the wonderful narration of Gene Shepard, who is unfortunately no longer with us. You know, so many of his you know, radio broadcasts and, you know, his spoken word stuff, so important in capturing the essence of this era. And, you know, the other thing, sadly, far too soon, Bob Clark, the director, killed very tragically a couple of years ago by a drunk driver.
Oh, wow.
Just short of, I want to say, the 25th anniversary. We have been around at many comic book style conventions, many of these actors. Billingsley, who plays Ralphie, is a director in Hollywood, and he
was,
does
he really?
Yeah, he does quite, wow, a bit of TV. He actually did the Couples Retreat movie a couple years ago, was his.
Oh, with like Jason Bateman?
Yes,
and all them?
Yes,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
The little brother Randy, we've been around. Ian Petrella, the Toady, who else have we seen? Scotty the Toy Schwartz. There's a whole story there. We'll get to him. The old man here,
the great,
you know,
Darren McGavin.
Yes, which really, you know, for all that this guy did, and he was, you know, Death Stalker, Night Stalker,
Cole Shack, the Night Stalker.
Yes. This is his emblematic role. This is how he is seared in America's consciousness, and I can't think of a better way to remember this man. The mother, you know, geeks listening in, you know, this is a fantastic geek joint, so you've got that, you know, in your DNA if you're listening to this. The mother, you may or may not remember, is the mom of the boy who gets abducted at the beginning of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Ah.
So, you know, she's got her geek stripes as well. And, you know, just a phenomenally cast film brought together wonderfully. And another idea, I've done extensive research personally and professionally in this movie. Very rare that you have a location that is both internally and externally shot. They shot in the house.
Wow.
They call it Cleveland Street. It was filmed in Cleveland. It's meant to be in Indiana. But the home was purchased a couple years ago and is now curated as a museum. Once a year, around Thanksgiving time, maybe a little later, they host an outdoor viewing. They've shown it actually on the back of the house.
Wow.
Where they've shown A Christmas Story. And you know, Ian Petrella actually went and, you know, Randy went and lived in the home 1 year to kind of function as a host and everything like that. And you're talking about a movie now that has since become a musical and, you know, like we said, spawned that really bad direct-to-video sequel that I will not watch in its entirety.
You know, Pete, looking at this kitchen here, I'm reminded of my great-aunt Lydia's kitchen in Carteret, New Jersey. And I think the house was built something in like 1918 or 1920 or something. And it just has that, I don't know, it's just certainly evocative of the old-fashioned era. The stove and the sink and whatnot. as we're treated to the sound of my dog packing up along in the bathroom. Okay. In the bathroom and on the floor.
It's got that wonderful middle America, you know, multifunctional aesthetic to it. You know, the big sink there for the washing machine and all the other stuff, as Ralphie's saying, you know, oh, I'll just take the Tinker Toys instead, Mom.
Well, you know, maybe I'm being a little cynical here, Pete, but the scene or two ago when he takes the ad for the Red Ryder BB gun and puts it in her copy of Look magazine, how the times have changed. Nowadays, the kid just says, Mom, get this for me. And Mom stands outside at GameStop on launch day in late, you know, late October, early November, and gets it and, you know, gives it to the kid that day and says, well, there's your Christmas present for 2 months from now.
I think it's just an Amazon wish list that, you know, they get forwarded the URL for, and, you know, Santa goes through that, and whatever happens, happens, right down to being able to browse the Amazon wish list, and it'll tell you if you go to click on an item, someone may have purchased this for you. So a kid today, you know, time was... and as the oldest of four boys, I have no problem admitting to ringleading expeditions to finding gifts, including on two occasions finding what Santa had procured for us. The first time of which, all of it went back, and different gifts arrived. Lesser gifts arrived under the tree.
Wow.
No less generous, but it was a trap. Fittingly,
it was a trap.
1983 Christmas. It was Return of the Jedi Christmas. And it was like, but wait, I saw Admiral I just put that out there. Yeah, that's why you don't... It was like a scene out of Arrested Development. And that's why you don't go looking for your Christmas gifts. And then one other time... you know, it was unintentional. We found it in the my dad had a small airplane at one point, and you know, Santa thought let's put the gifts in the plane, they'll never check it. And we went out to the airplane actually to help my father clean the airplane. Was, you know, one of the chores, and lo and behold, we opened up the back and there was Christmas inside it. So yeah,
these imagination,
the vignettes,
there you go, they really add such a wonderful charm. I remember just as a kid, it wasn't even me, I remember my friend Jesse explaining to his younger sister what the X's, why there were X's on the eyes of the banditos, what that meant, how it's not really real, it's all pretend, which I guess actually then pushes my memory of the movie back even earlier than high school.
I first remember hearing about this movie. There was a barber shop we used to go to, and the barber mentioned it. And I want to say it was like 86, 87. It first hit HBO in 85. And it was one of those things, like so many things, you know, you caught on HBO and all right. But it hadn't gained traction yet as far as a... You know, like so many things do, it takes several years and viewings and et cetera, et cetera. And you could see where, you know, for the early, even to mid-1980s, where the nostalgia just wasn't there yet.
Mm.
And then when it hit full force, and the idea of the leg lamp and, you know, the kid dropping the F-bomb and... you know, the Bumpus Hounds and all the other stuff, and add to that, as a piece of writing, the dual layer. If you take away Shepard's narration of this film, it appreciably loses something. It is a different movie. This is a perfect example right now where, you know, Mom is outfitting Randy in the snowsuit, and the figurative language employed by Gene Shepard is beyond superb. Okay, the simile in a second here, you know, that he's gonna employ like a tick about to pop, okay? It's simple, it's understandable, and it works. You could turn the regular audio off and still get everything. I almost wish, and if you're listening, producers of the 35th anniversary Holo disc that we're going to make, because we know Blu-ray is already on the way out, can you please make an isolated Gene Shepard audio track so we can just watch it without, and I have to hear poor Randy moan terribly as he leaves the house. Here's a perfect example of the seamless integration between the interior and the exterior as they head out into the snowscape.
I mean, there certainly is an authenticity to the exterior setting, and yes, it's all the better that the interior is the actual interior. But, like, I don't know. I mean, you know, here in New Jersey, we've had snow like that, but that's kind of how we that's how we imagined it is in the holidays. It's not actually how it is most holidays here heading into Christmas, that there's this degree of snow kind of perpetually. But it's that mythic Christmas where, unless you grew up south of a certain line, you had a shot at a white, yes, Christmas, even if it was just a dusting. I know there was about 5 or 6 years in a row in my, I don't know, 10 through 15, 12 through 17, somewhere in there, where we got at least snow in the air, yes, on Christmas. So, of course, the memory turns it into, oh, that's what it was like for us, too, even though it was just like, look, there's snow that's melting when it hits the ground.
We've just had the first speaking introduction to the pre-Macaulay Culkin of his day, Scotty the Toy Schwartz. And we'll go into that nickname in just a little bit. But this is a guy that I've spent considerable time around at various conventions. Wonderful guy. You know, there are people that when we've encountered them, Matt, you know, and the people watching happens, hold their fans or their watchers at a distance. And this is a guy who gets right in there and mixes it up with you. First encountered him at the Chiller Film Festival about 7 years ago on a day that it just rained buckets shortly before. That's always held right before Halloween. And, you know, never forget, I was there getting an autograph for a buddy that I work with by the name of Sean Casey from Randy. That was the request from my buddy. So I'm getting him to personalize it. And sure enough, Scott... And
for Casey, you would not strike out.
I would not strike out. So sure enough, Scott Schwartz hears me ask Randy, Ian Petrella, to personalize this photo for Sean Casey. And he starts right in. He's like, Sean Casey? Like, wait, the Cincinnati Reds first baseman, Sean Casey? And it led to a whole conversation. And, you know, I didn't have to pay Scotty Schwartz $20 to interact with me in a forced way, as opposed to the way I had to pay Ian Petrella to look up and sign something for me and take the personalization. I felt used. It was, I've never participated in a drug deal, but this is the closest I've ever felt. It was like, you know, hey, here's the money, you do this. It felt unsavory. And Scotty Schwartz really got me through that transaction by making, it was small talk,
right,
but it was meaningful small talk, if there's such a thing. And then later on, we wound up, you know, out under the overhang. It was really, you know, sweaty in the lobby of the Parsippany, whatever we were in. And, you know, the guy is out by an ambulance crushing a cigarette, and he, you know, again, you know, hung out with us, and it was a really cool thing. That's awesome.
By the way, Pete, do you know how they achieved this scene here?
I do. It leads perfectly. Excellent. Segues perfectly. So in talking to him and, you know, again, done extensive research into this film.
I think we should mention, in case people aren't watching along, yes, listening along, it, of course, is the stuck scene, in case the audio of...
Yes.
didn't sell it for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, the famous tongue to the flagpole scene. That is not an actual flagpole. It is a cardboard tube painted to look like the rustiest ass flagpole that the state of Indiana may have had to offer at some nondescript day in the 1940s. To the point where you can't watch it and not feel for the kid. They rigged a vacuum. You can actually hear it click on.
Really?
Yes, if you listen really close when he sticks his tongue to it. And that is what is affixing the tip of his tongue to that flagpole. I don't remember in terms of our discussion how many takes or whatever it took, but was a tremendous conversation to have with him. And a really iconic scene.
I'd like to ask you what the hell kind of school this is. What's the teacher's name?
Oh God, I know her name too.
Well,
Miss Shields.
Miss Shields, right. Oh, Pete, do you think she works for the agency? Anyhow, I was going to make that joke when she first came in.
Yeah.
She's only not
person,
there.
By the way, I should stress, there is an official sequel to this film. It is narrated by Gene Shepard. It is written in part by Gene Shepard. I will have to double check if it was directed by Bob Clark. I want to say it was not. And it has two names. It's called A Summer Story. It is also called I can't remember right now until I check it, but they recast just about everybody in the movie. Okay, Charles Grodin is the old man. One of the McCulkin kids is the younger brother or Ralphie, one or the other. But Miss Shields is the only one who is back, and it's essentially a cameo. It's the last day of school, and boom, they're going away to a lake, and it's a whole thing there.
Well, what kind of school is this where, A, she's not in the room as kids are there for the start of the school day, whether you want to call it homeroom or whatever.
Right.
And then they're apparently in recess in the snow, completely unobserved. Like, I don't know. As I said before, and Pete, we'll just skip the age jokes entirely.
Yes.
We were not alive in the 1950s. Maybe times were different then. I know if you had a beef with somebody, you'd put that block of wood on your shoulder and say, knock it off. And then you would just get to fisticuffs and you'd work it out by way of, bloodying of the face. But seriously, there's nobody out there watching the kids on this tremendously cold, deep snow day. I don't think it's unfair. I'm not certainly criticizing the movie. It may be completely of the period.
The sequel is again dually titled either My Summer Story. I've also seen A Summer Story to go along with A Christmas Story. It's also called It Runs in the Family. Came out in 1994. It is on the YouTube entirely if you look for it. Although all the traffic that will be generated from this will make it. They'll pull it right down. You're not missing anything if you've never seen the
I think it also
sequel.
Look, I mean, we all have an imagined shared Christmas past, right? Not everybody grew up with snow at all. Not everybody grew up with certainly in this time period, but this movie taps into the mythic Christmas that we all think we had or wish we had or thought about having or something like that. Summer vacations are a very, very different thing. Maybe you just stayed home. Maybe you were, on a yacht down the Nile for 8 weeks. Maybe you visited the grand, capitals of Europe, like whatever it might be. There's so much that summer vacation is not. It is not a shared experience, whereas Christmas is. That to tack together the Christmas experience with a little story about the bully, as we're seeing here, about life in school, about et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. I can see why it failed. Like, why didn't you just go? Why didn't you call it Christmas Story 2 and have it be 5 years later?
Right. I mean, and there's the toady is, you know, Grover Dill is the other one we've been around at a lot of these conventions. Just, again, the narration's spot on. I think the
and that Randy gag is so great. Just play possum. You're the smallest of the bunch.
One of the funniest, you know, from a peculiarity standpoint, they make Scott Farkas. I thought it was Scott for years. It's Scut, S-C-U-T, which sounded unbelievable until, you know, I was able to look that up. They make him, and the narration really dovetails with it to make him this, you know, he's got the yellow teeth and the eyes and everything. This is a kid that if you watch any of the respective reunions, grew up to be a handsome guy, you know.
Really?
Not for nothing. But that he played the bully and that they make it, you know, that he's gross. He does get his ass kicked later on, though.
This is true. You know, I was thinking earlier, at kind of anticipation of the scene that's about to come to us, about the Little Orphan Annie stuff, that there's probably some sort of semi-subconscious, if not completely subconscious, direct line between the radio scene in Annie and then this movie, where it's like the flip side of listening to the radio show experience to my interest in radio shows that became my interest in podcasting. So I think it probably is, you know, Annie and this movie are kind of the prologue to the prologue to the prologue of the conversation we're having here now.
Yeah.
Pete, it's the snake eating its tail. It's just coming back on it. What's going on? Good score, too.
It is. I mean, there's a lot of Peter and the Wolf when they do the bully scenes. But again, and I think good writing, too, lends itself to hyperbole. You know, one thing I would always stress with writers is this idea, this cliche of, well, they had countless hound dogs. No, they had 785 smelly hound dogs. It just,
that's
it rolls
better
off the tongue, and the hyperbole works at such a level.
Yes, countless is marginally cliche, hyperbolic.
Yeah.
785 is hyperbolic. Although the one thing that always sticks with me is it right here, the ear in the door.
Yes.
Have to feel for the.
It's not real. You can clearly make it out that it's a piece of brown felt.
Pete, what? This isn't real? You mean wait?
It's not. They wouldn't hurt an animal. This was long before the no animals were hurt in the making of this movie. But I think they knew better.
Wait, this guy looks like Kolchak the Night Stalker because he is Kolchak the Night Stalker.
Yes.
Is this a sequel to Kolchak? Wait, I thought Kolchak and the Night Stalker was a documentary, as is this.
It's in the same continuity.
This isn't like Survivor, but they don't do confessionals? It's in the same continuity. Bravo, bravo. And then we're now about to see just one of the worst behaved children in cinematic history.
Yes.
Probably seconded only by a unique callback, Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
As food sculpting scenes go, this is definitely up there.
This is second only to
the mashed potatoes.
Yeah. So the milk bottle milkman thing. I guess that's before the whole, like, before Big Milk got involved and it was, like,
I think
pasteurization
this is before
and shipping and stuff.
The rash of illegitimate milk children as well that really came about as a result of such a,
Wait, what is an illegitimate milk child?
Well,
do
the milkman,
I want to know?
Man.
Oh, the milkman. Oh.
The postman only rings once, but the milkman, he don't ring at all.
I guess not. This is just, as a parent, this is just, you know what? Ma, no. No, I just, Ma, I reject thee.
I think it's great. And again, it's couched so well by Shepherd's narration that every family had a child that wouldn't eat, whether it was just you and a brother, you and a sibling, or, you know, being the oldest of three like I was, there was always somebody that struggled with it. And this was, you know, coincidentally, this was the picture that I had Ian Petrella sign and said, you know, listen, huge fan of the film. You know, there's a really unsung scene later on that when Ralphie's going to get it, he hides under the sink and he is pouting. He's afraid his brother is going to die as a result of beating up the bully. You know, daddy's going to kill Ralphie. And, you know, I referenced that to Petrella. I was like, you know, that scene where you're under the thing, man, you know, totally sold that as an acting moment. And he looked at me like I had lobsters crawling out of my ears.
Right.
If you look real good, perfect example of the mise-en-scene, what they choose to put in the frame there. You just clearly saw on the front of the Fragile box that is being delivered, where the stencil was cut off on the one side, and rather than it saying this end up, they cut the T off because it wasn't wide enough. It's a hint as to what is in the box, but it is sure to get his end up. There you go.
I actually heard that was because the box was too big to fit through the full. Like, they had to stop filming to make it one plank less because it wouldn't fit through the door.
You can clearly tell that if they chose to, they could have gotten it off.
I guess I'm not entirely disagreeing in that at the end of the day, this is the work that the authors have given us. Therefore, we judge it as it is, not how it was created. So I rather like his end up with the arrow. I like that interpretation there, Pete.
Well, I mean,
by the way, great music moment coming up here. Not just the strings with the tension, but really kind of hammering home the particularly for, you know, me as a young lad where I didn't quite fully appreciate it. Then the music tells us, I think, here it comes.
Yeah, statue.
And the brilliance there too, he's reaching up towards the smallest curve of the rear end, but it's out of frame. So it's both kind of, because how old is he about here? Like 9?
Yeah, 9, 10.
Like, it's speaking to, you know, the future and all that, but they're not quite smutting it up enough to show him really going all the way.
And this disembodied leg.
Right.
You know, and we live in an age that, okay, you can't really expect many kids today to understand the risque nature of this major award. And then he puts it in the front room window. I mean, again, this is where we rely upon the mom's performance, you know, with Melinda Dillon here helping us to understand this is a taboo in the front room window, but it's the old man's house. That's where it goes. And he's going to go out in a second and tell the idiot Pollock neighbor, that's a major award. Respect it. You know, we know it's sexy because they played the sexy music with it.
The clarinet told us it was sexy.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, you know, let me ask you this, Pete. Fast forward to Christmas Story made in 2013, would the old man have a portable hard drive filled with just the most rancid images from the internet?
You couldn't make even a version of this movie today. It just doesn't translate to our time. We were talking before, you know, you pad in, you know, there is no retcon is wrong because we're not going back, we're going forward, but there is no analog digital to this analog of, you know, the leg lamp or the gift wish or, you know, so many of these things. I mean, how many parents will not bring a child to see Santa because they're worried about predators?
Right.
You know, and not to say, and again, not to, you know, downplay any of that concern. It certainly is a real concern, but, you know, and not that it didn't happen in this day and age. I think we know it did. But, you know, there's an innocence at the same time with the maturity that's going on here.
He's Swedish, not Polish, the
neighbor. Polish, Swedish, you know, we're in that part of Europe. So there you go.
It's all Europe.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw online, I don't know whether it was this Halloween or Halloween 2012, there's a guy...
Hang on, great line. Again, you can't write it any better, you know.
It's like it should be a either Walt Whitman or some sort of mid 1950s fiction writer, electric sex gleaming in the window.
Oh yeah.
There's this guy who lost a leg to cancer, and then his Halloween costume though was he shaved his leg. His one remaining leg, put on the fishnet stocking, had a shirt that ballooned out to kind of that ruffle at the end.
Oh, wow.
And put on the high heel.
Wow.
And it was just like, you know what? F you, cancer. Dude, here's my costume. And it was on Twitter and all
Halloween
that.
Halloween costume 1, cancer 0. Here's another thing. You know, we talked about the vignettes before. This one takes it to the next level.
Yeah.
Every kid, you know, has... you know, wanted to turn in a paper and have this happen. And every teacher, and I think, Matt, we have a little bit of experience in this realm, has dealt with getting some crap slid across the desk there with the idea that it is somehow, you know, worthy of something else.
I tried to grade faster than Miss Shields is going, though.
You know, even the cover looks like the Catcher in the Rye of Ralphie's.
it's just such an interesting theme, you know. It's choosing to go for the recognizable, you know. I mean, it's not a romantic scene, but you know, the music, that famous music of finding perfection, perfect love. But then also her dress, which is kind of, what would you say, like it's a generation previous to the 50s. So that's just kind of...
Yeah, it's marmish.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I love, watch, he goes around, you know, he's accepting the praise of his classmates here, and she's overcome in her praise. She's taken the plus sign. She is now drawing on the wall. She's drawing blue chalk plus signs on the wall, okay? And he's being carried off. It's just, and the old champion, you know, salute with the two hands there. You know, everybody at some point, you may have been the worst student ever, has entertained the notion that that's going to happen until all of our dreams are crushed.
And the quick cut of the soundtrack. It's a better, it's a deceptively technical movie. It's more technical than it appears. Yeah, you kind of, you know, you put everybody in, you know, 1950s garb and have a couple old cars driving around and have people say, you know, daggummit. Oh, let's listen to the radio and, you know, Little Orphan Annie, and it kind of, it underlies, I mean, even this, you know, where it's sped up, you don't need to see them chased again. It's
right.
Clearly a daily thing.
One can kind of see where it was unsuccessful on its first release, because it almost demands additional viewing to get, again, that traditional aspect down. You know, how many of these movies... You know, It's a Wonderful Life, not completely successful when it was released. And, you know, the outcry this year when it was even floated that they might pursue a sequel, which has since been crushed under the weight of outcry, it's heresy.
Yeah.
Same way I feel it's really heresy that they went ahead and filmed a, you know, not so... sequel to this last year.
Just a money grab. I mean,
it is.
Which
it
is why I think most people are going to be like, no. Like, if you made a sequel 2 years after the fact, in 1985, yeah. and had everybody back, whether it was good or it wasn't good, it would be like, all right, well, they're trying. Maybe they're trying to make a couple bucks, but at least it's honest, you know?
For what it is, the 94 piece is not completely unwatchable. There is a charm to it, and much of that is Shepard's narration. But, yeah. No Gene Shepard. There's another narrator to the sequel, which I think you would have been better off just going without. It's a fail.
I remember as a kid feeling like, and you know, you're a year or two older, so you could comment here, but feeling like this movie, maybe we didn't use these words, and I certainly don't mean it literally, but feeling like this movie was a prequel to The Wonder Years, at least in terms of its presentation. I mean, obviously, you know, this is the 50s, Wonder Years was the 60s, so on and so forth, but is there some sort of unofficial connection there, at least in your mind? Like this, not that this did well, but enough to be like, hey, this kind of movie touched people, or, you know, this was good even though nobody saw it. Let's do a TV show, but instead of the 50s, it's the 60s. Your thoughts, Pete?
I just think that, you know, though it was kind of released at the wrong time, it tapped in with the right audience. You're talking about 40 years on, and then yeah. it just gathered steam Christmas to Christmas. It got more popular and more popular. And now there's the show on Broadway. And now there's, you know, I mean, we know a guy that we've seen at a lot of these conventions, Cassine Gaines, who previously wrote a book about Pee-wee's Playhouse, who this year published for the 30th anniversary, published a book about this film, which, you know, is a tremendous asset to all the tradition that it's already established.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly coming up to the big moment here where if you're under a certain age and you're watching this with parents, maybe the parents have forgotten a little bit about, you know, how there's some of the dammits and the hells in it, but they just kind of glide quickly enough. This is where if you're beneath a certain age, you need to kind of like, Mom, what's going on? I don't understand exactly. Right. Fudge isn't a bad word.
It's not.
Fudge is what we get on Easter. Sometimes there's little marshmallows in there. So I think we should just take a little listen, Pete. Let's luxuriate in the
Let
fudge.
It breathe.
That's right. And Darren McGavin plays it without a sense of comedy.
Perfectly.
It's full on, this just happened, and now is not the time to deal with it with a flat tire and bolts that need to be found, but there's going to be the day of reckoning, and it's going to come. And also a little bit of kind of the 1950s gender stuff of like, the day of reckoning is going to come when I tell your mother and she has to deal with it, because I got to go downstairs and drink my secret scotch. Again, to return to the music. I mean, this is music befitting, you know, the man being led to the guillotine,
yes.
or the hangman's noose, or the firing squad, which of course is the aesthetic, but I've never noticed him crying in the background with his glasses off. Here we go. Ha ha!
The reaction is just,
yeah, that's where it tips its hand toward the comedy. Finally, that's the payoff. Fantastic. Pete, did you ever get the soap in the mouth?
I don't specifically remember the soap in the mouth. I do remember, you know, I was going to say, every kid, I think, particularly boys, has that story when they were first caught or somebody in the family was caught or whatever. And, yeah.
I don't remember soap in the mouth. I remember being told about how I had reacted to it, you know, in a time before memory, that kind of thing.
Right.
Now, Pete, the up, not to break the fourth wall here, the upstairs phone, to me, obviously a bit of a dramatic allowance in that you want her just to walk not very far and make the call within sight of her son. Does it speak to a certain sense of wealth? Two televisions. That's almost like Back to the Future. What do you mean? Nobody has two television sets.
The reaction of Mrs. Schwartz over this only makes it that much better as she beats the ever-loving life out of the other friend, Schwartz.
And then,
which ironically is not played by Scotty the Toy Schwartz.
Ah.
Which we're still going to go into that that name, dear listeners. Don't you worry. Ooh.
It is funny, kind of. I think as a kid, you miss a bit of the subtlety where it's like, this is a serious thing that he's done. So mom attacks it on a certain level, and then Mrs. Schwartz just totally goes overboard. Like, little boys and sometimes little girls say naughty words, and you learn not to, and you deal with it, hopefully, slightly disproportionately, so the kid learns never to do it again. But this is just, this kid has got his butt handed to him while the other kid is crying in bed.
Yeah.
From having let his parents down, sort of thing. And what kid, perhaps of a younger age, what kid hasn't said, "Ah, one day I'll show you know what? I'm gonna fill my knapsack and I'm gonna run away," or whatever it might be.
You're gonna see. You made me blind.
And you know, even in their performances here, like now their performances are slightly over the top in that, you know, it's not real. So whether it speaks to the acting, the directing, whatever it might be, it really is. It's well done. It's well done. And then Ralphie full on over the top here. And then the smile, saying, "Ah, all the blindness was worth it to hurt you because you were mean to me."
I gotcha.
Then the pièce de résistance.
Which, again, context begs that you understand how hard it was to get fresh, exotic fruit like a pineapple at this time in history in the Midwest. An orange. You got an orange in your stocking. That was like a year-long thing to look forward to, you know, in talking to relatives who grew up around this age. In parts like these.
I remember even growing up with frozen orange juice, and at a later time, maybe when I was 10, 11, 12, just thinking, oh, my parents just must have been terribly, terribly cheap. And then seeing something on History Channel to find out, like, there was a fresh orange juice distribution system set up in the late 80s, early 90s, that prior to that, you could get fresh orange juice, but it was like 4 or 5 times the cost. And like, you just, if you just wanted to have orange juice in the house for your family, right, like you just simply wouldn't get the fresh stuff. That just wasn't cost effective. So
this is true.
To kind of extrapolate that out 30 years even previous is quite a thought.
Now, this is a pivotal sequence in the movie. You know, he's got the secret decoder ring now. Everybody of a certain age at one point sent away for something in a cereal box or on the back of some other consumer item, and you waited with bated breath. This 6 to 8 weeks. Exactly. This was a rite of passage. So in one of the earliest incarnations of this type of campaign, he sends away for this, and now it's putting it to use. So you got the thing on the back of the comic book, you got the decoder pin, whatever it was, and now you're gonna try it out. And we're going to see if it was all it was cracked up to be.
I remember in first grade, I had a book that I got at the book fair or something called, I can still see the cover, Free Stuff for Kids, where you could send away for whatnot. I dare say I fared better than old Ralphie is about to here. Because this is, I wonder if you could even get away with this now. Like, this is Joe Camel, the cartoon, you know, smoking cigarettes.
In a social media world,
right,
like the other analogs to these situations we're talking about, they would probably be tweeted at. There would probably be a Facebook campaign to stop Ovaltine from perpetuating this. They'd actually have to have an actual secret
right
on the end of it.
I guess the flip side is this also speaks a bit to kind of the buzz marketing kind of, you know, like alternate reality game, you know, thing, even though it's done to crass marketing purposes. By the way, speaking of Ralphie being, you know, about 10 or so, I think we have a really subtle joke coming up that if you're beneath a certain age, you get, and if you're above a certain age, you know, it's one thing for the brother to be knocking on the door, but then Ma's starting to wonder what's going on in there.
Yeah. Which is doubled up. We go from one type of humor to another in the montage from one season or from one scene to another.
Right,
is great when he lifts up the toilet bowl.
Great editing here too, kind of picking up the pace. I'm not going to quite go there. I think there is a certain reading, which I think you certainly were alluding to.
And whatever passage of time it's been since he was caught saying the F word, he's right, dropping, you know, that. Now watch this. Brother goes in, picks up the lid, and what do we pick up? The lid of the
yes,
the red cabbage.
It really is
wonderful stuff, by the way.
It really is reprehensible the degree of kind of, you know, in story marketing that they would do. Which is a nice time to remind people that if you want to support the podcast, you can head over to fantasticgeek.blogspot.com or shieldpodcast.blogspot.com. Click on the PayPal link. Even a little bit goes a long way, particularly this time of year as we look ahead to paying Podbean for those bandwidth and storage costs. So,
a crummy commercial?
Son of a bitch.
The old man's nonsensical cursing is sublime.
Indeed it is. Now, there was reference made to the damper or something like that. You closed the damper. It was the bottom switch. What in the world is that? Now, I'm not saying you would know that, Pete, because you were alive back then. No, I want to stress that. What is the damper in a furnace?
You got to understand, I am not the most handy guy, and I have no problem saying that. I understand my limitations. I can mow the heck out of a lawn. Oof. I can pick up me some leaves. I'm just not a damper guy. There's a reason I keep my professionals in my area when I need them in business, because I know I'm not a plumber or a heating expert.
Well, let's, Pete, I've just looked it up on the Wikipedia. Damper, open parenthesis, flow, close parenthesis. It's a plate or valve that stops or regulates the flow of air. Oh, so it's like the opener thingy to your vent.
Yeah, I would have thought it had something to do with that because of the stuff coming through.
Okay. But then what was the other one? Was it just the heat itself, the thermostat? I would assume.
I think so, yeah. I don't understand the ins and outs of it so much. I just know it's bad.
Kind of a battered, I mean, the leg there, it speaks of a lady of ill repute having been roughed up in spite of or perhaps because of her lascivious profession. And you have to feel both sympathy and perhaps a sense of justice. And then mom there in the background laughing is wonderful. Is wonderful.
Yes.
They don't sell it. You could look.
Yeah.
What's the director's name? Bob Clark?
Bob Clark
could have gone for the most there, played to the back of the theater, do cut to a close-up as she giggled. Instead, the scene becomes rather boring. Your eyes drawn to the motion of it falling apart. Then it is simply falling apart, and you're looking for something else because it kind of can't fall apart anymore. You know he's going to pick it up. And there she is in the background, quietly laughing. Do I see her laughing? Is she... What's going on? And then she does it again. It's just perfect. Absolutely perfect.
So, Scotty the Toy Schwartz. Let's finally get at the nickname here, okay?
Indeed.
So, he was indeed the foremost child actor of his day in the early 80s. He was the most established child star in this film. You would have thought he would play Ralphie, yet again, they cast everyone perfectly in this film. There's not anyone who is miscast. And in a supporting role, he was in another movie with Richard Pryor called The Toy.
Ah.
Okay. And this is a guy who grew up, you know, he was in another child hit, Kids Incorporated. Was another one.
Okay.
And so he gets his start as a child actor, and then, like, happens with so many of them. I think it's, you know, the child star that struggles with this is, you know, like a Webster, like a, you know, name your child star du jour. They're improportionately shaped for their age, in that they're cute when they're young, and those proportions do not translate into adolescence or older ages, and they're just not the type of draw they were later on. And I think some of it has to do with ability as well. So he grows up, he's just not getting the parts anymore, and what do you know, he became, and there is a true Hollywood story on this, he became the foremost speaking actor in what we know politely as adult movies, to the point where he won awards for being the bellhop or the delivery guy. Not a performer in adult movies, but an actor.
The tier
in adult
upper
movies.
Wow.
Yes, and to the point where it then gathered a life of its own. Let's see him perform, and it was a failure as an experiment.
Wow. I did not know one could make a living in the pornography by not doing the pornography.
Clearly, you can gather quite a bit of praise as Scotty the Toy. This is where he derives his nickname, Schwartz, did.
It's like my hero and yours, dear listeners. LeVar Burton always says, I can go anywhere. I can be anything. Here, of course, we have, with a capital J, Justice. Now, of course, nowadays, this sort of reaction would be wildly inappropriate. You should report this behavior
this
to your...
This is Columbine your... stuff right Indeed. Now, man. He is talking... There's a lawsuit. There's all sorts of issues.
Ralphie, of course, should have gone to his school anti-bullying coordinator. Investigation could have been initiated within 24 hours of the report being first lodged.
Yes, and Fantastic Geek does in no way endorse such street justice.
Now, the fact that what's the bully's name? I'm sorry.
Scut Farkas.
The fact that Scut Farkas has not offended Ralphie racially, ethnically, due to gender, sexual orientation, religion, ethnicity, nationality. Can it really be bullying? My understanding is it might not be.
He did hit him squaw in the face with a snowball. And he was called a crybaby. So names were used. Mm.
But, now, but if you can call it simple...
simple assault?
No. If could that snowball and could calling a crybaby, couldn't that just be simple horsing around? If so, therefore, it's not bullying. And it's a number that you don't need to report to the county and state, which is usually kind of the incentive. If you can call it not bullying, then you don't have to, and then you're not a place where bullying occurs.
It really might depend on perspective. Just bears pointing out as well, he absolutely throttled that other child. Like, that was a street-style beatdown.
Yeah, that's a lot of blood. Kudos to the director, again, to have the blood on... Scut Farkas's left side while the right side of his face faces the camera, because that's a lot of blood. That is a lot of blood. Great performance out of Ralphie, too. Like, I genuinely buy that he's crying right now due to being emotionally overwhelmed from bullying and a physical outburst that he recognizes is not proper, is not socially acceptable, that has let his parents down. Like, I don't know, did they run cold? What's the cold? Vapo rub? Did they
get the Vicks going?
Yeah, did they put Vicks underneath his eyes to get those tears going? Like, I just buy it, man. This is a set. Were they like... Hey, young actor kid, here's a new puppy. Actually, no, we're going to drown it. And action.
You know, and here's the scene I was alluding to earlier. You know, Randy is beside himself crying under the sink there. And, you know, it goes to show it's emblematic of a... of an older brother and a younger brother's life and what they mean to them.
There's a picture of me back in the day sitting underneath the counter at my parents' house, kind of in one of the doorways that opens up to like the corner. I guess you'd normally have a Lazy Susan there, although my parents didn't probably. Right. My dad felt it was a fancy rich person thing to have a Lazy Susan, that he would not be lazy, he'd be enterprising and put a Kool-Aid jug down there that would never get used. But memories. And then the knowing mom, win the battle, win the war.
Close him up, man.
Close him up.
Put him back in there.
That's right. Just don't sniff the soap flakes.
No.
Seriously, that looks like a kid who was just crying. There's his eyelashes are bounded together by liquid. Nasty Bumpus. It really is a great score.
It is.
Here we have the clarinet not being sexy time, but just kind of being
and,
whimsical.
And again, much of it, from elsewhere, but really does sell it. Sell the moment.
Now, Pete, I see he's reading one of those Jigundalist newspapers that of course have with the problems of the print media have now shrunk to I believe now major newspapers are printed on a single 8x11.5 piece of paper.
You can still get 11.5x17.
Oh, good.
Quite a bit.
I was worried. Great, great, as you said earlier, great writing there. Just the old man is sniffing that there's something going on. Yeah. And then Ma starts to kind of, you know, turn it around, but he still is like, what's going on? And, you know, then she just starts talking about the Packers and the Bears. And he's like, oh, yeah, let's talk about that instead.
Previously having played stupid to the sports talk from the old man, and now when she can, I think like all good women, they hear it, they choose not to acknowledge it, but when they need to use it.
Indeed, it's there. Will. It's in the old memory bank.
It's in the memory bank.
Now, Pete, what is the Christmas movie nowadays that will be the modern classic in 10, 15 years' time? Is it Elf? Is it has you know yet to be made? Because I feel like Elf is a similar movie that kind of captures something.
I'm almost concerned that Elf gets a little too carried away with itself to be taken at a tradition level. I mean, listen, every age develops its own traditions. The one I feel, I think age of a movie matters too. You know, we're talking this one's 30 years old. What's starting to gain a lot of traction is the Griswold Christmas.
Yes.
Christmas Vacation. You know, Netflix went out of its way to secure it this year, whereas years past, NBC's made a big deal about showing it.
Yeah.
It has been on broadcast, but that it's
chopped to pieces, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. That Netflix has it, that you could watch it at any time. Yeah. Again, it is one that, you know, is on a lot of, lists. Does not count in terms of your favorite Christmas or your favorite vacation movie because the Christmas one has to be seen as a different animal than, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Regular National Lampoons, the European, or even the bastard child, the Vegas Vacation. I would seriously suspect anyone who would name Vegas Vacation as their favorite vacation film.
Just as you said earlier that you would challenge the listeners to claim that they saw Christmas Story in movie theaters, I think that you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who saw Vegas Vacation in theaters.
Vegas Vacation was on video in 5 minutes.
Leaving the theater,
yes,
you could buy
it. They handed out copies of it.
Now, I will say this, aside from the fact that it is not the world's best Santa and we're about to have the boot to the face in a bit, this is a heck of a cool...
It is, and this is very much, you know, what I remember early in my life of the department store setting. We're going to get a cameo in a second here. It's important to point out from the film's narrator.
Is it the... Well, I'll let you
if
explain.
If you listen. That is Gene Shepard in his cameo. And you can just make out that baritone quality to the voice. It's him. And again, a great sequence here. But I remember being in, you know, an A&S, which, you know, people will remember as an Abraham and Strauss or JCPenney's or whatever, back when stores were true stores and not so much spaces. They had identities to themselves. You know, there was a great mall at the Jersey Shore that I spent a lot of time in as a childhood, during my childhood, that is no longer there. One of the anchor stores is still there, yet the rest of the mall is gone.
Interesting, slightly odd use of, you know, the MGM Wizard of Oz likenesses. I don't quite entirely get it. I know there was a whole stretch in the 60s and 70s that it was on, was it Thanksgiving? Was it ahead of Christmas time? Like, I know there's some sort of holiday association with Wizard of Oz that I grew up hearing about, and they're kind of like, oh, I guess it's not on this year, that kind
of
thing.
I think a lot of those Universal classics, you know, Wizard of Oz, Sound of Music, the original Julie Andrews was on last night. You know, they bogart them and try to play them at a point in the holidays to really kind of garner viewers. It's a big deal. The kid we saw before with the aviator goggles on, you know, and so many of the kids are wearing that getup. Just again, perfectly played, you know. I like the Wizard of Oz. I like the Tin Man. And sold again by Shepard's narration, you know, the idea of scoffers and you don't want to be a scrub at 0 hour and the urgency that's lent to this. And what does he do? He gets on Santa's lap, this kid's hardcore with the Black Watch plaid pants, and he pees himself on Santa's lap. And the really sadistic elves.
Yeah.
You know, this lady here just frightens you.
This whole thing becomes frightening as it's more and more from the children's point of view.
Well, the fisheye lens really sells.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, as I recall, it's like the boot to the fisheye lens.
Mm-hmm.
The slide part is pretty cool, though. I'm sure nowadays with liability, there's no way. And let alone the fact it's not wheelchair accessible to get up there. Like, it's a whole, like, it's a whole thing. Yeah, it turns. And a little bit of red on Santa's nose just sells something. Yeah.
You spin it around. There's that.
It's uncomfortable to watch intentionally.
You know, I have never understood what kids find frightening about Santa. This helps me understand what could potentially be frightening.
The fact that intentionally or not, it's slightly out of focus.
Yes.
Which I can only imagine is unintentional, but it's perfection.
Is great. Just the dashing of dreams and the dejection into the cotton there and waiting to be collected by the parents. I mean, this would never happen today. Parents would never allow their children to wait for Santa alone. Right. Forget it. No picture was taken, too.
Right.
Okay.
Let alone, just thinking, you know, to be completely cynical here, the retail space that's been gobbled up within the store,
undoubtedly,
as opposed to, you know, in the mall setup where it's like you have the neutral spot, which is the fountain that you drain on Thanksgiving, or the whatever spot that's just underneath the staircase, whatever it is that you can fill, but otherwise is not a retail spot.
A lot of the dissolves in this film just really set the tone so well, and they, you know, close in on Santa and then open up on the Christmas tree here. Really draw the attention.
Now, I never had a Christmas tree growing up that was had tinsel like that. It was like the strings of garland, but it wasn't kind of the loose tinsel. I don't know if that's a time thing, or again, if my parents were just a tad on the...
We had the garland tinsel as well.
To do something like this in a practical location as well is just fabulous.
Hi. we have largely, I mean, in my married life, we have been exclusively a artificial tree family. I prefer to say
everlasting.
Yeah, peat. I remember growing up. 1 year we had a fake tree, and it was just not what it was cracked up to be.
Yeah, I remember my grandma always was the one to have the real tree, and then kind of the year came where it was discussed. Maybe we won't this year, and then whether it was that year or the next year, it just kind of came to pass, and it kind of was. I don't know. It was the passing of an age, certainly.
You know, this idea of hearing Santa, I mean, we talk about the analogies between this age that the film is set and now. I mean, now with NORAD and Santa tracking and all these other resources, I mean, we know where Santa is to the exact line of longitude and latitude, as opposed to, I think I heard him, which, you know, we always paid attention for, you know, listening for reindeer on the roof and that kind of thing.
Well, Pete, I have three distinct memories, and I believe it is from two separate years, the chair separate from the other two, but it's kind of blurred into one. These are memories that I, how do I put this, so I mean it kind of with an adult sense of accuracy. I remember these memories clearly. I'm of course not claiming that they are true to fact, you know, but 1 year I remember going to bed, it's Christmas Eve. My dad would oftentimes stay up, you know, he'd fall asleep on the couch and come to bed quite later. But whenever he was coming to bed, there'd still be some kind of light on. My bedroom at the one end of the house, the kitchen at the other. I remember hearing a kid, you know, of course we did the whole leave the cookies out thing, hearing the telltale sound of a chair in the kitchen being pulled back, waking up looking, and that there was no light coming from down the hall. I think that's one memory separate from the other two, which is hearing something scratching on the roof and saying to myself, could it be Santa? Well, it could just be the trees. And then, honest to goodness, again, in the memory, I'm not claiming it was truth with a capital T, hearing the sound of sleigh bells and just being this absolutely magical memory of something that to this day I remember actually having occurred, you know. Again, I don't want to sound like, you know, truth of the capital T, but those memories are so clear. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Who knows? I guess, Pete, the spirit's still alive.
I have had so many wonderful Christmases that, you know, the memories so merged together. I mean, I can remember distinct Christmases, but was and remains just always a special experience, you know, both with my own family and then, you know, with my folks and everything there.
Seeing the bedraggled parents, I remember there was 1 year, both my brother and I had the ubiquitous yellow Walkman Sports
from a previous
Christmas or birthday. And we had set the alarms with one of them. I think it was mine. The buttons were particularly hard to press. You had to really press down in a way that probably was a default or defective. We had set our alarms for 5:35.
They my had parents an had, alarm on them? I'm surprised.
As I recall, yeah. And my parents had talked us down from like 5 o'clock in the morning, and we did like 5:35. And I think my parents were just like, yeah, we'll see, we'll see. We slept on the floor, my brother and I, with them ready. And it went off. Oh, it's time for Santa, time for Santa. I was like, no, go back to bed. Wait till later. And at the time, it was just like, oh, man.
Listen, I can beat you on that in that, you know, try growing up with a father who was an obstetrician, you know, in seemingly every Christmas of my childhood, he got summoned to the hospital in the middle of the night to deliver other Jesuses. And, you know, sometimes he made it back for Christmas morning. Sometimes we had to wait. Okay, to the point where my youngest brother eventually had a chain lock established at the top of his door to his bedroom so that he could not open the door and go down and start Christmas on his own.
Wow.
Yes.
That might have been in violation of fire code, although...
Well, listen, certainly man, the sentiment, you know what, back in the day, sorry, there were things that superseded fire code, and I right. happen to happen to side with my parents on that one.
Certainly.
Well, I couldn't go down. If I had to remain in my room, otherwise yeah. Christmas was canceled, he should have had to remain in his room.
I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the marshmallow test. That they'll take a kid that's 5 or 6 and say, do you want one marshmallow or two? They'll put a marshmallow in front of the kid and say, do you want one marshmallow or two? Oh, I'd rather have two, says the kid. All right, well, if you can wait, they'll give a period of time.
Right.
If you can wait 10 minutes, you'll get two. Oh, I need to go step out of the room for a second. Let me leave this marshmallow here. Meanwhile, behind the mirror, there's the camera and whatnot. And, you know, can the kid wait the period of time? Yeah. How long does the kid wait?
I've seen this. Yeah.
That is, they've extrapolated that test out into later in life. That is a huge indicator. Like, how well you do in the marshmallow test at age blank, whatever the normal time is a massive indicator for your success later in life. Because do you have the wherewithal to say, I will not drink and drive at 17 today. I will delay the gratification. Will I engage in certain behaviors right now, or should I go to the drugstore and drop $1.50 down? Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I go out tonight? Should I study for my test tomorrow? Et cetera, et cetera. So,
where do you think the wearing of embarrassing pajamas is on the gratification scale?
I think this speaks to Ralphie being a good guy, that he knows he looks moronic, like a deranged Easter bunny, as the old man just said, but he does it because it is the right thing to do. He clearly, Pete, is the oldest brother. Says I, the oldest brother.
If I remember correctly, Aunt Clara makes an appearance in the Summer Story.
I would hope so. That scene seems to write itself. Yeah. I guess they don't do crumple as you go in this house.
I guess not.
That seems to be 101. You want to let your kid build the potato mountain, fine. You want to, like, whatever, you want to drop 10 fudges a day around your kid and then act shocked that your kid repeats it, okay, just say, hey, before you get to open that next one, throw the paper over here, Ma has the garbage bag.
Now, this is a scene, I think it's even a little bit undersold, but this is really the soul of the movie. You know, Ralphie has struggled this whole time. You know, I'm not going to get the one gift that my holiday is built around. And, you know, it's a make or break deal. And I don't know if it's my idealization of this film, but I have happened to have felt from personal experience it's worked this way for me. And here, Dad went against Mom's wishes, but it's no different than putting the leg lamp in the window.
Yeah.
Woman, it's my house, and I had a BB gun as a child, and my son's going to get one because, you know what? That's what men do. We raise men in this house. Okay? And lady, you might be able to cover for him when he gets into a fist fight and I never find out about it and kill him. But damn it, he's going to shoot at small animals in the backyard, and that's just the way of it. So get behind it or get out of the way.
See, I don't think Mom, I think that while, I think she had dialogue a little bit earlier, like, why did you put it over there? Like, I think Mom is a bit more complicit than you think at this point.
Yet everything that she says comes to pass. He shoots his eye
right,
out.
Right.
Okay. He breaks the glasses.
Well, you know what? Maybe that's part of the not to get too heady on what at the end of the day is a look to the past, but maybe that's part of why this movie is so universal. A movie that took place, a movie that was set 30 years previous to when it came out, a movie that 30 years later is still feels so authentic. That you do kind of have these universal gender roles where, you know, Mom's kind of a stick in the mud, and Dad, who is gruff, and Dad, who's not caring the way she is, still finds a way to express that. But damn it, Mom is still right at the end of the day. They're both right.
Right. So now the turkey subplot starts, and, you know, later she's going to admonish him, don't pick at it, you're going to get worms, which, of course, anyone who knows science knows that there are no worms in poultry. We're, of course, talking about salmonella. which is a bacteria.
You said earlier that the reveal of the rifle is underplayed. I disagree, because I think as an adult... as an adult, you know, sometimes you don't get the present you want. But as a kid, you keep on believing, but you're also happy with what you got. And I think there's kind of this, like, hey, I remember the time when I didn't... For me, it was Super Nintendo. I fought to get Super Nintendo. My brother and I went in on it. That was our request. And that was the year that we were going to Disney World too. And we were told there weren't going to be any Christmas presents. And we understood why. Because we were going to Disney World for Christmas. And then it still came. And it was that magic. And this ties into that, the magic of it.
Oh, I'm not going to disagree. I just think the reveal of it could have been played for a lot more grandeur, and that's where Clark really reveals himself to be an efficient director. He doesn't oversell it.
Right. What other movies has he done off the top of your head?
I couldn't really recall without looking.
Fair enough. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. There really is an interesting, I'm going to repeat what I said earlier, there's a timelessness. Yes. To the really traditional gender roles going on here. Not that, you know, not, I'm not saying this is the way it should have been, or this is the way it was, and this is the way it should be, but there's a timeless, these two really are a team set in the 50s, not a 50s dynamic kind of imposed upon the thing.
No, you won't. Not if you're not eating pork. She's referring to trichinosis. Again, breaking the look to the camera, yeah. Is just priceless.
Which it is, and it is. I mean, yes, technically he's breaking the fourth wall, he's looking to the camera, but he is narrating the story. Yes. Like, we're aware, he's aware that we're out there because he's telling us this story.
Yeah.
The fact that the kid does it, you know, is you know, again, it is obviously a break to the fourth wall because the kid wouldn't have actually have done that, but it's all part of the magic of Christmas. Now, it's been many years since I've seen this movie. Of course, you know, every scene just about is seared into my brain. Or I should say, since I've seen it beginning to end like this. Certainly, you know, catch at least part of it, if not all of it on... Is it TBS or TNT?
TBS.
TBS. I remember as a, I don't know, 10, 11-year-old, being really struck by, you know, when they go to the Chinese restaurant, some of the misspoken English in that scene. I'm curious to see how it holds up here.
I mean, listen, I always make a point of watching this once on DVD before the marathon, and then I make a point to catch every moment of the movie during the marathon at some point, beginning, again, 8 o'clock on Christmas Eve. You know, and I think it speaks to, you know, we take for granted... Much like the fruit before, the turkey,
yeah.
You know, you most of us don't even pay for the turkey. We get it with green points or whatever nowadays. And, you know, to lose it all and everything that they got out of the turkey and that they have to go to the bowling alley with the Chop Suey Palace Company attached to it and celebrate Chinese turkey with the... not so racist.
Yeah, jar. Yeah,
you know, it's not. There's no racism going on here. You know, it's funny to watch younger people, you know, say younger people watch this show, but you know, or this movie, teenagers today react like that's inappropriate, but it's not.
This is an uncut scene. This is probably 20 or 30 seconds. It's been going on and on. So I feel like some of the reactions that they're having are authentic. Now, Pete, if you were directing the movie, would you have the kids know that they're about to chop the head off the duck here? Or would you just go for through the window, you have your master shot still going, and just go, let's just play it for, not even tell the parents even, let's just play it for, I mean, let's look at the reactions here. If I was the director, I wouldn't have told anybody.
It seems really an authentic reaction.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a writer, I'm not a director, so right. You know, I'm gonna go with Clark's vision here as far as the way they shot it. It works perfectly down to the kids taking the utensils in their hands and banging them on the table.
I feel particularly the younger brother, if you watch him, he appears to be looking at the mother and Ralphie for kind of improvisational direction. So I think that
this to me is you know, in my adulthood, the quintessential Christmas moment, to sit in the light of the tree with no other lights on in the house and just enjoy it and enjoy the presence.
Enjoy the fact that Christmas has come.
Yes. You know, and it was 65 degrees in New Jersey here the last day or so as we're recording this. But the temperatures are plummeting, and just hoping that we might get a little bit of the white stuff on Christmas, you know.
Snow as well, Pete. Pete, your regular co-count, you are. Pete, here's a question for you. Is this a perfect Christmas movie? Or is this about as perfect as you can get? Or do we view this through the lens of when it came out, the fact that it's played every year, it's become this thing?
I mean, I'm biased. This happens to be my favorite. I mean, it's up there for me with It's a Wonderful Life. But It's a Wonderful Life, as Capra intended it, not explicitly a Christmas movie.
Very, very much a, you know, film noir downer of a movie that kind of starts at Christmas, ends at Christmas, and is this, is a downer.
Now, you see in the credits here, Matt, there's a Flash Gordon that is credited. There is a cutscene, another vignette that Ralphie imagines that did not make the final cut.
Wow. Still credited nonetheless. So,
you know, they were very lucky in the filming of this to get the weather that they did.
Yes.
Again, a perfect storm of conditions and casting, expertly directed by Clark, wonderfully narrated by Shepard. And, you know, this is a movie that 100 years from now, people are going to be watching on
their
whatever format.
Direct brain access.
Yes. You know,
Memoratrons.
It will be downloaded instantaneously into their consciousness, and they will suddenly gain awareness of this experience as if they had it themselves. And, you know, they will be better for it.
Indeed.
There's something about the period Christmas movie, and this is what I think puts Christmas Vacation ahead of, like, a Home Alone at this point, because it's a little bit more period specific, despite the, you know, Home Alone, again, is not explicitly a Christmas movie, but you know, Christmas Vacation has all those trappings of the late 80s, you know, Clark working at the food additives division of the conglomerate and everything, you know. Similarly so to a movie like Scrooged, although entirely yeah. too derivative of the original work. But, you know, this movie's a treasure. It will eventually find its way onto the congressionally protected list and the AFI Top 100 after being released to really lukewarm praise.
Well, Pete, this has been a jolly viewing here of A Christmas Story. It definitely a classic, definitely a modern classic with its storied history of meager box office all the way to as the box says there from is that the Chicago Tribune?
Yes,
a classic. We have it right there. So, Pete, do you have any final Christmas time thoughts?
This is 93 minutes of holiday perfection. If you are watching this and you own the DVD, or you happen to have fired us up as you're checking out the 24-hour marathon, you can't come away from this film and not feel a little something.
Absolutely. Yeah, whereas it's not quite as emotional as, say, It's a Wonderful Life. It's not kind of as reminiscing of the spirit of childhood the way Home Alone is, or really a certain sense of freedom that Home Alone taps into. This is kind of, you know, as I said earlier, it captures that mythic shared Christmas that we all think we had, even though we didn't.
They're not saving lives. You know, we're not going back to the reason for the season, you know, but this is the perfect American Christmas tale. It is commercial yet anti-commercial at the same time.
Darn Higbees.
It's comfortable in both milieus, and it really captures the essence of an age and of Americana, something I think that is increasingly rare in the times that we're living in.
Wow. Well, on that wonderful note, Pete, I think I can add nothing to that. So I will say Merry Christmas to one and all our listeners. I think we'll certainly have a few goodies on the old podcast feed and some odds and ends to share between now, perhaps even in the new year. But I'll just wish Merry Christmas to one and all. And of course, Pete, it'll be oh so fitting. You're the one that suggested watching this movie, suggested the watch along. You came over here today, so you, of course, get the final word.
Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night. The weak and full strong.